Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Nigel Gould-Davies, the Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Nigel has a great deal of experience as a diplomat in the region. He was the British ambassador to Belarus from 2007 to 2009 and has also been the head of the economic section at the British Embassy in Moscow. Thanks very much for joining me today, Nigel.
It's a pleasure. It's great to be here again.
All right. It's great to have you on the show again. Now, before we start, I just want to mention a recent change in the format. For, I think, about a month now, we've been conducting this podcast not on the social network formerly known as Twitter, instead recording it in the studio. This is a return to past practice, but with a twist. While we won't be taking questions live because it's being recorded, we are inviting listeners to send questions on the topics at hand in advance. And I see that a question has come in for today's podcast that's on the topic, so we will address it towards the end. Now, usually we tackle two or three separate themes or developments on this podcast. This time, we're going to focus on a single one, the death of Yevgeny Prigozhin, leader of the mercenary group Wagner. But we'll look at it from several angles. I guess we can say death now rather than presumed or reported death because the Russian Investigative Committee said yesterday, on Sunday, that it had confirmed the identities of all 10 people it said were killed in the crash of a business jet in the Tver region between Moscow and St. Petersburg on August 23rd. Now, I wouldn't trust everything that the investigative committee says, but this may be the closest we ever come to certainty in this case. Russian authorities said there were 10 people on board and, of course, no survivors. U.S. and other Western intelligence sources told the Associated Press that a preliminary assessment had concluded that an intentional explosion caused the crash and that Prigozhin was very likely targeted. Now, why would Putin target Prigozhin? I'm not saying the AP named anyone who may have caused the crash, but asking the question, why would Putin target? There's obviously been a lot of speculation that the Kremlin may have been behind it. So the question, why would Putin target Prigozhin? His acquaintance for three decades or so, and a man who helped the Kremlin in many ways for many years, whether it was in meddling in U.S. elections, backing Russia and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the war in Syria, bolstering Moscow's influence in several African countries, and, of course, fighting in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, where Wagner forces were instrumental in the seizure of the city of Bakhmut in the Donbass earlier this year. Why? Well, because Prigozhin's forces carried out a mutiny on June 23rd to 24th, 2 months prior to the plane crash, that brought his forces within 200 kilometers of Moscow and presented Putin with probably the biggest challenge of his 24 years as president or prime minister. In short, because he made Putin look weak. But what I'd like to focus on here is not the cause of the crash, or if indeed it was deliberate, who was behind it, but on the consequences, whoever was behind it, and again, if it was deliberate, the consequences, the potential ramifications for Russia and its war on Ukraine, and also for Belarus, where Prigozhin popped up and Wagner forces appeared after the mutiny in June. Let's start with Russia. As I said, the mutiny made Putin look weak. I think that was really a broad consensus among people who are watching Russia. There was a lot of talk about it being the beginning of the end for him. After the plane crash, now there's a lot of talk about Putin looking stronger, at least in the short term. So my question, what's your view on that, Nigel? And in terms of the consequences for Russia, is there anything in particular you'll be watching for signs of how things may play out? For example, will Putin come under substantial pressure from the kind of nationalist pro-war people who, like Prigozhin, are vehement critics of the way the Russian military is conducting the invasion of Ukraine? Or will Prigozhin's demise send, as many suggest it was meant to, will it send a message to those forces and to any disgruntled people in the Russian military and security services that they should not rock the boat?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. So there's a lot there. I will just start by just glancing back at the fact of the destruction of the aeroplane itself, and just make the observation that within Russia itself, I don't think anyone is really doubting the proposition that Putin was behind this. I mean, it's technically true that there are several reasons why a plane can fall from the sky, but really, the overwhelming likelihood at this point, the working assumption, I think, pretty much of everyone looking at this, is that one way or another, Putin was behind it. He certainly had the motive, the means, and the opportunity to do so. A couple of thoughts about the fact that a plane crash, was the apparent instrument of death here. I mean, the first thing is that it meant that not only could Prigozhin be killed, but pretty much, well, certainly a large proportion of Wagner leadership also on board, including crucially Dmitry Utkin. So it was an efficient way of decapitating the organization. In addition, and no one's really drawn attention to this, there were three entirely innocent people also killed: the pilot, the co-pilot, and the stewardess on board. So there's a certain, perhaps unsurprising, indifference to innocent life. There's the fact also that Putin is known for the exotic means he chooses to regards as traitors, whether it's a Novichok military-grade nerve agent or radioactive polonium, in the case of Alexander Litvinenko. There may be a sort of a resonance or parallel in the fact that Wagner, in its march on Moscow a couple of months ago, shot six Russian military aircraft from the skies. So it just may be there's a kind of, you know, an intended sort of parallel there. The final point about the plane crash is that there is an investigation underway. They have to come up with a version of the cause. It's not as if Prigozhin was found sort of lying in a pool of blood in an alleyway, and you can say, well, he's just killed and the killers got away. They have to say either there was a technical fault or there was a mysterious explosion, or it was brought down by a surface-to-air missile. And only the Russian state could do the latter, and very few people could do the second of those, put a bomb on board. So let's just see what the official version is, because they do have to go through the motions of the investigation. Now, to the consequences, I do not think this makes Putin look stronger. I think the whole Wagner affair, from the mutiny through to this, at least part of the denouement, makes Putin look weaker. And to the argument that he's restored his position because he, you know, apparently has been able to kill the person responsible for this, what he said at the time was a treacherous act of rebellion, I respond by saying that it makes everyone even more unsettled now, because there was an apparent understanding in that sort of quasi, frankly, criminal way that this regime now works, a panyatia that traded, in effect, Wagner and Prigozhin's agreement to end the march on Moscow in return for some guarantee of his safety. That word, Putin has, in effect, broken his word. And that makes everyone that much less confident that he in future will keep his word to those around him. Now, you might very well say, well, Putin, you know, has a long record of lying and dissembling and so on. And that's true to those, you know, openly treated as enemies, particularly those outside Russia. There's no reason why his word should particularly be believed. But in respect of elites, the people around him, the sense that he generally reaches understandings on important political or regime-related questions, then agrees to that and sticks by his word. That's been a sort of stabilizing element in the regime. And I think a lot of people here will now say, well, he's so capricious that it's actually hard to have faith in any undertaking he makes, even to a current or former close associate. So I think it's one more example of, as it were, the slow degeneration of this regime.
That's a very interesting take, Nigel. Thanks very much for that. And again, there's been quite a bit of debate, I think, about how it makes him look. Thanks for pointing out, of course, the innocent lives lost, killed in this crash. There was also, I would say, from the Kremlin, from the Russian state, kind of not totally ignored, but tended to play down and not speak much about the, I believe it was 13 people killed in the when Wagner forces shot down the six aircraft you mentioned, I believe. So that's kind of par for the course. Now, I'd like to also ask, actually, one thing I'd like to go back to in what you just said, the idea that, which I also found very, I hadn't really thought of this very much, that the Russian state, the Kremlin, is going to have to come up with a reason, a cause of the crash, and that if it's a surface-to-air missile, then that would point to Russia. What about, would they be able to say or claim, I mean, I don't know how believable it would be, how credible, but that some kind of rogue Ukrainians or Ukrainian-backed person shot it down from the ground?
They might try to do that, although I would expect that if that was their intention, they would have pointed that finger or tried to make that claim already. And yes, we know that they can concoct stories when it comes to air crashes, and a lot of elaborate work of disinformation was done in trying to present a false and misleading explanation for the MH17 crash, if you remember, which was brought down by a Russian missile.
Yes.
And they tried to point the finger elsewhere. But I would have thought at this stage that, firstly, if the claim really would be that it was a Ukrainian missile, again, they would think they've begun that work already. Secondly, the idea that a Russian plane deep in Russian airspace over Tver, I think it was, yes, flying yes. between Moscow and St. Petersburg, was vulnerable to a Ukrainian missile, there's an embarrassing sort of other side to that particular coin. The implication would be that actually it's unsafe for Russian aircraft to fly, certainly within European Russia. So I think that would, you know, raise as many questions as it purported to answer. I suppose one sort of further, sort of broader point I'd make is that this action, of course, is part of a broader crackdown on the more extreme hawkish end of the spectrum of criticism of the Putin regime. The repression of the liberal end, of course, and the anti-war end has been underway since the war, perhaps since before the war started. And now there is a kind of a reckoning. Putin has belatedly realized that his critics to the right, so to speak, now present a threat. But in this case, unlike the others, he did not arrest, detain and arrest Prigozhin in the way that he does has done with, you know, Girkin, Strelkov, and also Surovikin too. Maybe he felt it was just in some way too risky and dangerous, given the degree of sympathy and support, at least in some circles, for Prigozhin, to actually arrest him, which is what you should do with the head of a mutiny. So I think that point is significant as well.
Absolutely. That's a great point. You know, how much more kind of credible would he be if he, how much stronger would he look if he were to go ahead and arrest Prigozhin? And good points about the idea that, of course, that would, if they say it was Ukraine shooting it down, then that, you know, presumably Russians might be afraid to fly anywhere in Russia. And also, you know, you mentioned maybe they would have gone with this story earlier. And there were, you know, there have been analysts or, you know, pro-Kremlin commentators pointing the finger at Ukraine and the West, but those have mostly been kind of more vague, I think, you know, Anglo-Saxons, Ukrainian. So, so yeah, thanks very much for that. Now, I'd like to ask also about Ukraine. As I mentioned, the Wagner fighters played a key role in the Russian capture of Bakhmut, though at a huge cost, as Prigozhin mentioned in his diatribes against Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and General Staff Chief Valery Gerasimov. And it may have been more of a symbolic achievement, capturing Bakhmut, than a strategic one. But in any case, Wagner fighters have not been on the front lines much, if at all, for at least 2 months, since many of them crossed into Russia from Ukraine to carry out the mutiny. So will Prigozhin's death have much of an effect on the war in Ukraine, whether it's on the battlefield or in terms of decisions made in Moscow?
Yeah, I'm skeptical that it will have much of an effect, and indeed skeptical that it has, at least in recent months, had such an effect. Now, yeah, as you know, the origins of Wagner lie in a close relationship with the Russian military intelligence, GRU. And there was a time, and I think particularly true when Wagner was most active in Syria, where it was a significant and effective force. And again, it had these links with military intelligence and special forces and so on. But recall, of course, that its ranks were replenished by scraping out the prisons. So you're looking at low quality, poorly motivated forces who died in extremely large numbers as a consequence partly of their own limited ability and lack of training, but partly also the extraordinary recklessness with which they were thrown into the field. I mean, in many cases, as you know, deliberately sacrificed, just sent across lines in order to be shot down and thereby reveal the locations of the Ukrainian forces. They were simply, you know, fodder in the crudest sense. The idea that Prigozhin has been, and Wagner has been in recent times, a particularly, you know, effective or innovative force is, I think, overstated. Prigozhin is responsible for the avoidable deaths of large numbers of Russians. The idea that somehow he has been conducting this war more effectively, more innovatively, and therefore merits the kind of, maybe I'll come on to this because it has implications for the longer term future, this sort of cultish support following in Russia is frankly a bit baffling. So no, I would not expect this to have any significant effect on the field in Ukraine. Wagner, in any case, I think is more broadly significant for some of its recent activities in Africa.
All right. Thanks very much, Nigel. Now, the last question I wanted to ask, that I wanted to ask, is about the ramifications for Belarus. Now, we've spoken about Belarus a few times before on this podcast, I think. As I mentioned, you're were the British ambassador to Belarus in 2007-2009. Now, Alexander Lukashenko, obviously the kind of despot in charge of Belarus, supposedly brokered the murky agreement between the Kremlin and Prigozhin that abruptly ended the mutiny in June. Wagner fighters were told, including by Putin, I believe, that they could go to Belarus if they didn't want to stay in Russia and sign up with the military, or that they could just go home. And there are signs that some have gone to Belarus, possibly quite a lot. On Friday, Lukashenko asserted that the core of the mercenary group, about 10,000 fighters, will remain in Belarus. And Prigozhin, before the plane crash and after the mutiny, popped up in Belarus at least once, if I'm not mistaken. And I should also add that these developments, the presence of Wagner in Belarus, have caused concern in the Belarusian opposition at home and in exile. Nigel, what's your take on how all this may affect Belarus?
I mean, ever since the apparent outlines of the deal that was struck to end the mutiny a couple of months ago, ever since that was struck, there's been a lot of sort of improvisation. I think that was an agreement made under conditions of extreme pressure on all sides, very, very kind of skeletal in nature. And a lot of details, including what would happen to the rest of Wagner, I think, was essentially still to be decided. And an early version of that was a lot of them would go to Belarus, and so they did in due course, not all of them, of course. There are signs now that some have been leaving, actually. A satellite imagery to suggest that some of that has been, some of that deployment has begun to be reversed.
Yes.
So there may be still sort of some lingering uncertainty, some even kind of decisions to be reached, and even disagreements, possibly in elements of infighting within the Slavic circles about what happens. I think keeping several thousand there serves some purposes. In particular, of course, it has been of heightened concern to the Ukrainians, who, of course, inevitably wonder and worry if there is this sort of significant new force. What uses might it be put to? Could it, in due course, launch an invasion, new axis from Ukraine's north? Even if it doesn't, Ukraine still has to anticipate that possibility and keep some units back in case that does happen. You might recall that in the leaks of U.S. intelligence documents early this year, the so-called Discord leaks, one of the apparent revelations there was the expression of Russian satisfaction that they had been able to perpetrate a deception operation, making Ukraine, and by extension, Ukraine's Western supporters, think that Belarus might itself launch an attack there. Again, thereby forcing Ukraine to hold some units away from the front line further east. So with Wagner forces there as well, whether they themselves might potentially fight or create the impression they're about to fight, or whether it's a matter of them training Belarusian forces, as Lukashenko has suggested that they might, that all sort of complicates things for what, you know, is in essence a single strategic space: Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia. You have to sort of see them all there together. But there are no sort of fixed certainties, I think, in the matter of Wagner's fate. So we, and of course Ukraine itself, should remain alert to the range of future possibilities.
Okay, thanks very much. And we have, our FERL has had some reporting from our Belarus service based in part on satellite photos, suggesting, as you said, that some of the Wagner forces who were in Belarus may have left, a camp being possibly dismantled. So thanks very much for that. Now, we're getting short on time, but we have, I mentioned we have received a question for a listener, so I will turn to that. This comes via X, and it's from Roland Marshall. Apologies if I'm mispronouncing the name. He asks, since Wagner Group mercenaries were reportedly paid double what the Russian Ministry of Defense offers, he writes 200,000 rubles versus 70 to 100,000 rubles, and given the current trend of supplanting Wagner abroad, will there be recruiting difficulties for post-Wagner Russian units in Africa and the Middle East?
Yeah, that's a good question. Indeed, one of the consequences of at least part of the Wagner forces being folded into the regular Russian military would be a deterioration of pay. Now, going back to the mutiny or the period before the mutiny, recall that of course, we'd seen this escalating, increasingly angry war of words between Prigozhin on the one hand and Shoigu and Gerasimov and the Russian military on the other. I think the thing that caused Prigozhin to pull the trigger to actually make his march was the fact that Putin finally sided publicly with Shoigu and said, well, look, by the end of the month, by the end of June, Wagner forces would have to sign contracts with the regular Russian military. That's the thing that caused Prigozhin to go for broke. And I think the signs are that we're going to see if not on a total scale, certainly a very substantial scale. And that will mean that Wagner forces, if they do agree to sign his contracts, will be accepting less pay. The pay itself is not, I think by Russian standards, even the pay that's being offered regular Russian soldiers, it's not trivial. And it reminds us once more that short of full conscription, because we had a partial mobilization last September, it was delayed and short and very unpopular, but short of compelling people to fight, it's either a matter of paying them pretty well or offering these Faustian bargains to get out of long jail sentences. And I think this points to a deep and quite important and possibly underappreciated truth, that it's not the case that lots of people really want to fight in this war. To put it another way, the response of the Ukrainian population and the Russian population when it comes to the question of whether they are really ready to take up arms to fight for their country is completely different. For Ukraine, of course, it's a war of defense. For Russia, even though the World War II narratives are pressed into propagandistic service, everyone sort of knows it's not really a war of defense. So you had to pay people well, or again, reach for the prisoners. There's little mass enthusiasm. And I think that's significant. I think the real test of whether a war is genuinely popular is not whether you sort of sit at the sofa in the evening and shout along with the propaganda that Solovyov and others are spouting out on television. The real test of genuine enthusiasm for a war is whether you're willing to fight. So the fact that these salaries, whether it's for Wagner or even for the regular Russian military forces fighting Ukraine, have to be pretty good, reveals the fact that while on the surface support for the war among Russians may be wide, I'm not sure it's very deep.
Absolutely. That's a very interesting point. You know, and it takes us sort of inside Russia and raises questions, obviously, about the future and what will happen with this war, which, of course, there are a few signs that it would be ending anytime soon. Okay, we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks for the question, and thank you very much for joining me, Nigel.
Absolute pleasure. Thank
All right, pleasure is mine. Once again, I've been speaking to Nigel Gould-Davies, the Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. I'll be taking a two-week break from this podcast. The next edition is scheduled for September 18th. Meanwhile, please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which comes out most Fridays. Thanks for listening.